My name is Tommy Andrews and welcome to the SoundSpring podcast. This is the place where creative musicians share the ways in which they turn their stories, ideas, and feelings into sound. During each episode, my guest composers will take you on a guided journey through one of their musical works. This is music, straight from the source. This episode features Ray Hearn. Ray truly is a unique and brilliant musician who spans across multiple genres. He is currently best known for his work as drummer and writer in British progressive metal band Haken. Haken have taken the prog world by storm over the last decade and won the hearts of millions of fans, including myself. Ray's playing has gained a huge reputation, gaining places in the top 20 prog drummers of the millennium in Rhythm magazine, and a place within the top 10 drummers in the world on Music Radar. Praise has not only come from the fans, but also from giants of the genre such as Mike Portnoy and Jordan Rudess. Haken have headlined tours in Europe, Australia and the USA, and toured with some of the biggest prog names on the planet, such as Between the Buried and Me, Leprous, The Neil Morse Band and Devin Townsend. You may think that this globe-trotting, poll-winning CV is extensive enough for a young musician, but Ray has a trick up his sleeve. Whilst Ray and I studied at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama together, his principal study was in fact the tuba. Even though he was releasing albums and touring with Haken, Ray graduated with a first-class degree and started performing as principal tuba with some of the top orchestras in the world, such as the London Philharmonic Orchestra, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and the legendary London Symphony Orchestra. To round things off and prove his versatility, Ray's tuba playing also features on one of my favourite recent jazz albums, Miguel Garodi's Apophenia. This album has some of the most complex and demanding writing I've ever heard, and it's well worth listening to. Before we kick off, I have a couple of exciting projects to share with you from former and future guests of the show. In March, I'll be chatting to Pete Latanka, and I just had to mention the amazing work he has been doing with the Anne Frank Trust. On the 25th of January, a short film called I Imagine That was released on Holocaust Remembrance Day. Alongside Catherine Wilde, Amina Jammer, the English National Opera, and young pupils from two schools, the film gives voice to young people and their hopes for a future society free from prejudice and discrimination. I'll put the link to the video in the show notes. It's really powerful and beautiful, so please give it your time if you have some to spare. Now, before we dive into my chat with Ray and explore Haken's song, The Endless Knot, here's a quick message from former SoundSpring guests, Minaihai.
Hey Tommy, Louise and Zans from Minaihai here. Just wanted to say a huge thanks for giving us a bit of airtime on your show today, your awesome podcast. Just to tell people that our new track, Lost to Kano, is out now on Bandcamp and all major streaming platforms.
So it's all about a trip we took to a deserted beach town in southwest Japan, and it features a rickety old upright piano, a celeste, and some bamboo sticks we found at the garden centre. Have a great interview with the legend that is Ray Hearn, and we can't wait to listen.
Bye. Bye.
Ray, thank you so much for joining us. I'm a huge fan of your playing and writing. I'm a big fan of your band Haken. I've been listening to you guys for years, so this is a real dream come true to be able to talk about your music. And also, it's great to see you. It's been a while.
Yeah, man. I'm pumped. Thanks for having me. And it's good to see you and talk to you after so long.
Firstly, I'd just like to congratulate you on your latest release with Haken, which is called Virus. It's a brilliant album. It's such a worthy addition, not only to your catalogue, but also the catalogue of progressive music as a whole.
Yeah, man. It's been going down really well. And, you know, it's the name itself has been receiving some interesting press, yeah, obviously, in this time. But, I should probably say, if people don't know who are listening, the title is completely unrelated. We actually came up with the name for the album, like, 2 years ago. And it just so happened to the release coincided with the biggest pandemic of all time.
We met at college at the Guildhall School, and one thing that I remember really vividly was rehearsing downstairs in the basement. And I think there was one particular occasion when, during a rehearsal, this absolutely killing metal band started playing really loud next door. And loads of people were sort of like, oh, what's going on? They can't be playing that loud. That's not okay. And I was, you know, being a bit of a metalhead, I was like, I want to be in that room. That sounds amazing. Was this around the time when you had just joined the band?
No, actually, that would have been like my first year of Guildhall. And I remember one particular incident that you're referring to, I think, where I believe we were auditioning our then new keyboard player, Diego. I'd been in the band for like a couple of years. I think I'd sort of joined up with the guys when I was around 16 years old. Yeah, all of a sudden, we sort of get interrupted by, I think it was Scott Stroman walked in.
Fantastic.
And like behind him were like all of these elite, like third and fourth year jazz musicians who I was just like really intimidated by because I was a first year. And then I was like, oh man, I'm really pissed off all these, you know, senior people at the college, and I'm just a first year playing with my silly metal band. I found the whole thing really embarrassing.
So you may term it a silly metal band, but now you're one of the biggest bands in the progressive music scene. And not only are you getting really rave reviews, but some of the biggest and most influential names in the scene are heaping you guys with praise. How does it feel looking back at things like rehearsing in the basement of the Guildhall and getting interrupted by jazz professors? How does it feel to look back and see where you guys have got to? I mean, I see it as an incredibly inspiring journey.
Yeah, it feels pretty cool, to be fair. We've definitely come on leaps and bounds since then. We've always had big aspirations and big ambitions for the band. I think probably most bands kind of start out that way as well. You kind of joke about sort of taking over the world almost and being the next whoever, and we've kind of always spoken like that jokingly, and then gradually things have just happened. We seem to be in the right place at the right time and things just fall into place, and yeah, things have just gone so well, album after album. We've tried to keep really focused and never kind of let the momentum die, always kind of riding on our sort of wave of whatever hype is going on. And yeah, it's just it's gone really well, and I hope it continues.
Progressive rock and progressive metal are very much associated with things like odd time signatures, complex harmony, syncopation, virtuosic playing, concept albums, long form compositions. I sometimes find that when a band or an artist gets kind of put in a box or a genre, that maybe sometimes they feel like they have to include those things in order to almost validate their position within that genre. I feel like Haken are pretty good at avoiding some of these traps, especially since the release of The Mountain, which was 2013, I think. But have you guys ever felt any pressures to kind of tick some of these boxes as part of your writing process?
Yeah, I totally agree with that, actually. And I think that's definitely a trap that a lot of progressive musicians or bands kind of fall into. We kind of probably fall into that trap sometimes ourselves, and we have to make sure that we're always, you know, playing and writing for the song, and everything else comes later. The complexities, yeah, they're probably going to be in there, but hopefully not just for the sake of it. If you listen back to our earlier stuff, there's definitely a whole jumble up of all sorts of different type, like genres and different feels and times, and it's kind of all over the place, and we're just doing it because we felt like it, but we weren't really thinking of the cohesiveness of the song. And now I think years on, we're always thinking of that first.
So in regards to the band's writing process, you've mentioned in previous conversations that it's become slightly more of a democratic process. I was wondering whether you could take us through some of the things you do as a band to navigate through this process of writing together.
I think we've always been relatively democratic from the beginning anyway, even if there was one or two sole songwriters. So from the very early days, that was mostly the case. It was mostly Richard, one of the guitarists. He wrote the majority of the music. But it was never a dictatorship in that sense, because he'd always present the music to us and then ask us what we thought. And then we'd kind of play around with it ourselves, and we'd add our own touches, and we'd vote stuff in and out, and it would be fairly relaxed. Yeah, you know, certain decisions might be a bit more pressurizing, and some people would be really tied to one idea, whereas other people wouldn't, and you feel a little bit of tension in the room, and then it subsides, and you just learn to live with it. But I guess from album to album, the more we all play together and write together, the more we all want to be involved musically, as in from a writing point of view. And yeah, definitely from my point of view anyway, I've always written sort of progressive-ish music from a young age, and I just kind of, I suppose, let myself grow a little bit through the band, through Richard's music, and started to become a bit more confident with my own writing. And then from albums like The Mountain, and more importantly with Affinity, that was when it started to become really much more of a collaborative effort between everyone. We kind of just opened the door for anyone who wants to contribute an actual song rather than just ideas from one of Richard's songs, then feel free and we'll see what happens.
So you've mentioned playing around with ideas. Does improvising or jamming together play a part in your writing process as a band?
It did used to have a much bigger part, again, from the very early days when we would just meet up and we'd write a lot of stuff that way, actually in the jam room together. And the first two or three albums developed in that way as well. But actually, again, to note Affinity as a bit of a pivotal moment, which is when Connor had joined, who's based in America. Up to that point, we were kind of a UK-based band, but then suddenly we're a lot more spread. Ross, our singer, moved down to Bournemouth. So we became much less of a kind of old-school jam band, and much more kind of just isolated in our writing process, and we would, you know, write our own ideas and just share them by email and just have a kind of sharing platform online that we would use to bounce ideas off of each other that way.
Even though you lost that feeling of being in the same room and the energy you get from that, did you also maybe feel on the flip side that this process allowed you to focus more at all?
Absolutely, yeah, because one of the big benefits anyway of working in that way is it kind of gives us all more space to digest the ideas, whether that be time or just the fact that there's no sound going on in the room and you can just sit there without being distracted by other people playing. So yeah, for sure, like it's really difficult when you're, at least for me and for some other people in the band, in a certain scenario, you know, we're coming to a certain section in a song and they have an idea or I have an idea, and it's sometimes really difficult to vocalize exactly what that idea is, and you have to say, you know what, leave it till next week and I'll kind of program something and then I'll show you, because I can't really tell you what it is at the moment. Whereas if you just kind of skip out that whole thing, it can potentially make things a bit more efficient and a bit smoother perhaps.
One thing I love about Haken and your writing is that to me there seems to be this almost inherent Britishness to it, and by that I mean that there's this kind of dry humour and wit and sarcasm and satire in some of your music, especially if I think about tracks like The Cockroach King off The Mountain. Do you think this comes about from your influences in the kind of British prog tradition, like Pink Floyd, Genesis, Yes, Gentle Giant? Or is this part of your characters as individuals? Or maybe have you guys decided collectively to kind of put this stamp on your music?
It's a really interesting point, labelling it a Britishness, which I don't think I've kind of had that comparison made before in that way. But actually, now that you've kind of explained the sort of thought process behind it, I totally agree. The humour aspect is something that's always been in our music, and perhaps is something that sets us apart from a lot of other bands in our field, because ultimately we don't take ourselves fully, you know, too seriously all the time. There's always some kind of humour in the music that we've written from, again, from way back when we started writing. There'd just be silly moments that were just there because we knew they were silly and that was that. And kind of as a group of individuals and as a group as a whole, we are just kind of very laid back and very sort of, again, we try not to take ourselves too seriously, and we're always kind of taking the mick out of each other, and it's just that kind of environment. That's who we naturally are. We're just, we might not be funny to people outside of the band, but sort of to ourselves, we're just kind of joking around and not taking things too seriously. And yeah, I guess it makes sense that then that becomes part of our sound in a way. And then in terms of actual influence, I mean, Cockroach King in particular is a really good example, because it was kind of our homage to Gentle Giant, who we kind of only really discovered around the time we were writing that song. And they're just the sort of kings of that kind of style of playing and writing and that humorous side of music.
After The Mountain in 2013, I was so excited for the next album release, and you guys did something really creative to build up the hype before the album Affinity dropped. And I remember your website turning almost into this kind of operating system. I think it was called Haken 4.0.1, and it was a bit interactive, and it really gave us as a fan base a kind of premonition almost as to what the vibe of the album was going to be. And I thought this was so brilliant. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think that idea might have come from Charlie, one of the guitarists. He's great at just coming out with these really, really clever little ideas. And the kind of era that the Affinity concept is sort of based around is like the 80s, and that lots of those kind of sounds come through in the music quite a lot, and lots of people have made a point that it's kind of supposed to be like a, I don't know, like a throwback sort of album. There's definitely a lot more modern stuff in there as well, but there's one song in particular, 1985, which is kind of everything thrown into the pot, sort of Finstacola, Transformers, Rocky IV kind of thing.
Yeah, that song 1985 is definitely my most played Haken song. I love Vince DiCola, and then coupling that with prog metal, my favorite genre pretty much, I was just over the moon.
Yeah, I mean, you put it pretty well there, really, that it's just a kind of subtle introduction of what the vibe of the album's going to be, and it had a kind of audience participation element to it, almost like whoever logged on to this website could then enter some bits of text, and then it would load some more text down the screen. And it was, yeah, it had this kind of immersive feel to it, which people really loved.
You've mentioned that your albums often have a concept. So could you take us through the concept of Affinity?
I think Affinity is the name of a computer satellite that is put into space with the kind of view of just basically logging human behavior around the world. And then in the process of doing that, it becomes conscious, or it simulates consciousness. And it's kind of a little bit like a typical AI conundrum. What do you do when the computer realizes that it exists? It's supposed to sort of coincide with this point in time, this kind of fictional point in time in history where humanity's kind of in meltdown and there's war all over the place. And lots of the concepts behind our albums, they're kind of quite broad spanning, and even kind of from song to song, although there's always a specific direction that we're following in this concept and a narrative through the album. Each song and each concept has this wider reaching aspect to it that applies to kind of even modern day current affairs or historical events or some kind of personal event that someone who's listening might be able to apply to. And that's something that we've always tried to do, even from The Mountain in particular. I think before then we were writing in a really narrative based way that it was like specifically to do with a story, but now we write in this much more In particular with the lyrics, this kind of more broad spanning way, so it can be widely applied to kind of as many people who are listening.
So how does this track, The Endless Knot, tie into the concept of affinity?
So kind of at this point in the album, the sort of global effects of man's mistreatment of the planet are kind of starting to bite back, kind of with all the wars going on around the world that I mentioned, these fictional wars. Food supplies are, you know, basically gone. There's famine and there's disease. There's a reference to this dying sun. I can't remember if that's in one of the lyrics of this song. It definitely comes back later in the album as well, that particular reference. Despite all this warning, because I believe the computer so complicated. This computer, I think, the Affinity computer, had sent warnings to its makers, essentially, sort of prophesizing what was going to happen. Mankind, as usual, never really acts on its sort of long-term interests, even as we're seeing today with the pandemic.
Absolutely.
It's a pattern that the computer, this Affinity computer, has seen over and over again, kind of this looping effect, this never-ending effect, hence the endless knot. That's kind of the gist of it anyway.
Right at the start of the track, we're hit with this really disorientating keyboard line, and then when the rest of the band comes in, it's really syncopated and complex and punchy. And I was wondering, with this track, were you just trying to hit the ground running?
Yeah, absolutely. The sort of disorientating nature of it is kind of exactly what I was going for. You may or may not kind of be able to hear that I was listening to a lot of Tigran Hamasyan at the time. I was definitely going for that vibe to kind of start the song off, just kick in with this kind of filthy rhythmic approach. And it's kind of almost straight. That's kind of the thing about it. It kind of lulls you in for a bar or two, and then it throws you around, and then it settles again. And it's... It's a fun start to a song, and I don't think we'd had anything like that up until that point. We dream of places we can't get to. We crawl, we swim, it's never ending. The crests of tidal waves are raging. The bits of lake is ever changing.
As most of the band then drop out, the guitar is left to set up the vocal melody for the verse. Is it quite hard in progressive music to find the balance between creating vocal melodies that are lyrical and melodic and memorable, whilst also retaining all of the kind of syncopated and complex stuff going on underneath it?
Yeah, well, naturally some sections lend themselves more than others, right? And we slave away at certain passages trying to get the right vocal hooks in there. It's definitely kind of the priority of any song that we write. If the vocal's not strong enough, then we just can't pursue that song any further. We had a problem with that with a song on Virus that I can remember well. We almost certainly had the same issue with pretty much every other album before that. There's always been one or two songs that we're really pumped about, but we just can't get the vocal. We can't get that sort of melodic content where we want it. And we have to just drop the song or save it for the next album until we've actually found something good enough for it, because we just don't want to compromise. It's all about the song, as I said earlier. This was quite a fun approach with the vocals, because it's a very rhythmic kind of 5/16 type pattern that locks in, as you said, with a guitar. And to be fair, I mean, it's a bit of a pain in the ass to sing. Yeah, it's not pleasant, but
there's not much room to breathe, is there?
No. I do feel for Ross, to be fair, but the vast majority of the rest of the song is a lot more free flowing, and a lot more kind of, I guess, traditional with the vocal phrasing, which I think is a nice contrast as well, to have those two different moods in the vocal rather than just having it all legato. You've got to have a bit of a mix.
One thing I really enjoy about this song is that even though most of it is in six, you guys are constantly changing the feel within this meter and switching up where the crotchet pulse is felt the most. And this feels like you're almost shifting gears whenever you're transitioning between sections, but the rhythmic drive never lets up. Are a lot of these rhythmic decisions coming from you as the drummer, or do you work on these things together?
I think a lot of the times when I write, because I'm a drummer, I sometimes write from the drums up. So when I'm actually constructing a song, rhythmically it's already kind of there. And then I just need to, either myself or with the help of some of the other guys, just kind of hone in a bit more on either the specific instrumental parts or harmonic or melodic elements. But with this particular song, it kind of, regardless of what's going on rhythmically in other instruments, there's always a driving pulse, you know, whether it be the kick drum throughout one passage, just literally laying out the pulse while the rest of the parts over the top aren't doing anything too adventurous. Or later on in the song, it will just be another part of the drums that's driving it while everything else underneath moves around. Perhaps as well it's helped by the fact that it's at 140, which is like a classic dance nightclub tempo, which you just kind of always want to dance to. And I know it's not a dance tune, but it's very much influenced by that kind of sound world. As you say, like each section has its own feel and own sound, but sort of quarter note pulse, it just never leaves. It's always really, really strong on top of everything else.
If we listen closely towards the end of the lyrics in the chorus, the synth part is playing almost like an echo of the verse vocal line. And I was wondering whether you guys are using these kind of little motifs within your writing to help your listener have something familiar to grab onto, even if it's a bit subconscious. I certainly use these kind of things in my writing where I almost assume like people haven't heard the music. So if I give them these little things to hang on to as they're taken through my compositions, it just allows them to feel like a sense of familiarity and context as they're going through something that they haven't experienced before.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it can be subtle enough for you to not even necessarily notice it. Like I know the part that you're referring to, and it's not exactly a prominent part in the mix. It's almost like a subconscious thing as a listener. You feel like you know the song even more, even though it's a new section. It's still the same material, just in different clothing, I suppose. And that's one of the really important things about composing. Not always, but the vast majority of cases, the more you can squeeze out of as little material, the better. And I think that was definitely on my mind the whole time writing the song. It's just trying to recycle as much of what's going on earlier on in the song and just develop the song in that way rather than coming up with new ideas.
You mentioned earlier about the kind of driving dance 140 BPM tempo, and we get to this section now, probably my favourite section in the piece, where we get this kind of dance synth metal crossover almost. This really heavy riff comes in and it's got this massive synth sound to it, almost a kind of dubstep type sound going on. I remember when I first heard it, I started racking my brains to think about whether there are any other bands doing this kind of thing. But I could only think about it the other way around. So dance artists using rock or metal influences in their music. So I thought of things like The Prodigy, who used quite a lot of distorted guitars, as did Pendulum. I guess the closest I could think with the metal band using dance influences or electronic influences would be maybe Periphery, but that's usually using it in their more kind of soundscapey moments rather than their riff-led moments.
We love that passage. It's always a fun passage, and especially when we're playing it live. In America, they just love pits over there. Just almost every show we play, they always just open up a pit at that moment. It's really fun. Because as a prog band, we're not usually treated to that kind of crowd.
Yeah. The next section features a guitar solo, and it happens over this new texture that we haven't really had before. Mm-hmm. A lot of instruments either drop out or are playing more sparingly, and the harmony has kind of got this fusion vibe to it. Is there anyone in the band in particular that brings this kind of influence to the table?
In terms of the actual fusion-esque sort of harmonic content, I really can't remember. But I know Charlie and Richard in particular, you know, they're big Holdsworth fans, and Greg Howe.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
And that's Charlie's solo, actually, and it's a great solo. I mean, I love the stuff that Charlie comes up with whenever he has a solo, because although he's inherently this metalhead through and through, like, he's the biggest metalhead out of all of us by far, he's just great at coming out with these really authentic-sounding, kind of diverse technically solos that you just, you know, hadn't heard before. He's great at kind of stealing from all of his influences. He's got such a kind of wide range of different guitarists that he loves, and he just pulls out these crazy lines.
On the subject of solos, I'm quite used to, as a jazz musician, playing solos in real time where the rest of the band and I are all interacting together. When you're writing a metal album, though, when you put these solo sections in, do you come up with the solos first and then, as a rhythm player, react to those solos? Or does all the rhythm section stuff go down first and then the person doing the solo just plays a solo on top of that? Could you take us through your process?
Yeah, it can vary. We're definitely not a jazz ensemble, that's for sure. So it's nowhere near as spontaneous as we'd like it to be. But it can vary. Like, I know there's one or two solo passages on Virus, on our latest album, that I would play something spontaneous sounding on the drums, and then Richard or Charlie or whoever was soloing at that time would then have to adapt their solo for that particular point. But I guess it tends to happen more that way than the other way around, because solos tend to be added later in the process, just because we're focusing so hard on the song itself, and you know, it can take a lot longer to really implement a solo, and that section might end up then just being scrapped from the song if we haven't finished writing the song yet. So it's kind of a wasted effort in that sense.
We then get taken into this really big anthemic section, which almost feels like a second chorus if you just take the track as a whole. But in the scope of Affinity, there's a wider contextual purpose here, I think. I think some of the lyrics and the tune hark back to another song.
That point, lyrically, it kind of draws back on some parts early on the album. Again, I think it kind of refers quite specifically back to 1985. I think the lyrics for that chorus of that song are their design shifting frame by frame. And then at this point in The Endless Knot, the lyrics are just turned around slightly, becoming our design shifted frame by frame. And then there's also a reference to the cycle at this point. The cycle starts again in 1985, but in The Endless Knot, the cycle starts to fail. We're further along the process and along the story, and things perhaps aren't going so well. And again, that kind of lyrical tying in as the album progresses is something we're always aware of and trying to keep it as cohesive as we can.
We arrive at this transition section and everything kind of drops out, but the time signature changes to 5. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering whether, because the volume and intensity starts to drop, mm-hmm. whether you took a beat away just to keep a bit of momentum as a kind of balancing act.
Yeah, it felt right because, as you say, so much, basically everything drops out except the keyboards. And again, they're sort of quoting this bit from earlier in the song. There's this kind of like half chorus near the beginning of the song, and it's kind of taking that melodic content again and helping it to build to the sort of climax. And I remember back having it in 6, it just felt like it all dragged too much. We've already had such a dip in energy by the whole band dropping out, essentially. So just cutting that beat helps to keep it moving along. So as you say, there's that a little bit of momentum by having one beat less in the bar, and then kind of as the section kind of crescendos and reaches its final point just before the kind of big chorus drops at the end, there's this extra beat added on to kind of prepare you for the going back into 6. Again, it's almost like a cliffhanger moment by having that extra beat, because you're almost thinking you're going to go straight down again, and you've got that sixth beat there on the end. It's funny. I remember when we were sort of deliberating this very final chorus when we were writing it, I kind of wanted to keep it in 5 because I wanted that momentum to carry on, and I thought this final chorus will be great in 5. And the rest of the guys, they were like, nah, it's got to be in 6. I was like, nah, I love it in 5. And but in hindsight, they were right, and it's much more satisfying and much more I don't know what the word is. It's quite indulgent. It's quite an indulgent final chorus. Like it's got that really anthemic vocal, and it's just really heavy and slow. And it's just much more satisfying being in 6 at that point.
That extra beat is a perfect example of one of the composer's most powerful tools, which is the delayed resolution. Mm. And by delaying expectations in the listener and providing them just after they think they're going to get it, you can invoke a much more powerful response in the listener. And you guys do that so well here. Mm. Just having that extra beat makes the chorus drop with even more impact, I think.
Yeah, and this is, as I said, the sort of climax of the song, so it just heightens that even more. And the lyrics at that point are so uplifting as well. There's quite a lot of hope in there. It's we need a story to believe in. We need a hero to prevail. Like, it's quite cheesy, but it's like a good, it's a great payoff after all of that craziness that was before it.
After the final anthemic chorus, we're treated to almost what's like an echo of the introduction, where we get that keyboard line coming back. But this time the feel is different. It's in a really slow five. So I was wondering, did you have to approach this slightly mathematically? Did the keyboard line just work in the new time signature, or did you have to do some kind of modification to make it work?
So it was kind of planned in advance. When I wrote the beginning of the song, I knew that I was going to recap it at the end, and I knew that it was going to be a straight version of it. And yeah, I mean, that's just a really good technique, I find, anyway, for, again, bringing a song together, kind of bookending it, as it were. So I basically had to approach it mathematically, as you said, because the sort of keyboard line that I wrote for the beginning is kind of all over the place. And there's these weird time changes that means it doesn't really add up to anything from the start to finish. It's just there's too many changes in there. And I was happy with that. The whole point was this disorienting nature of it. It didn't take that much to even it out into it's essentially in five, the very ending. It's like a slow 5/4. Or you could think of it as 4/4, because the drum part in the hands, at least, is effectively playing in four. And then you've got this kick drum pulsing underneath every 5/16 notes. And the whole phrase, when played together, kind of makes a long bar of 5/4. And again, that's like a big nod to Tigran Hamasyan, who just seems to love fives even more than I do. It only took kind of omitting one or two notes here or there, and then it just evened down to five. But I think I even just wrote that section after I wrote the intro. I kind of just wrote a variation on it that I knew I was going to finish the song with, and then I filled in the whole middle over time.
Well, thank you so much for taking us through The Endless Knot. It's such a great song. It's from such a brilliant album. Your whole catalogue is fantastic, to be fair. Anyone listening that enjoyed this music, please go and check out Haken and their catalogue of amazing albums. I really feel like as a band, as a progressive band, you are really true to that nature, in the sense that every album is a real progression and you bring something new to the table each time. And I just want to thank you guys, because I feel like you're really rejuvenating the prog scene with your music. So thanks.
Yeah, man. Thanks again for having me, and for it's been nice to go into this much depth with a song as well. Kind of, as I said, I felt like I almost had to revise just to be here, and which is bizarre because it's kind of my music. I really hope anyone who's listening who doesn't know Haken goes and checks them out.
Well, you're not off the hook yet. We've got to run you through the quick fire question round gauntlet.
Great.
Don't worry, we'll start easy. What kind of things would you like to see put in place to make music education maybe veer slightly more towards creativity and self-expression?
More student-led education, basically. Because that's definitely one of the problems with music, for sure, is that a lot of teachers or educators, they kind of get stuck in this rut of having an idea of what's right and what's wrong. And that's not really what music is about. Like, when I'm teaching drummers, for example, especially young kids and beginners, and they kind of start apologizing if they make a mistake or they play something that's kind of different from what I've asked them to play, they start to think that they're not doing the right thing and they're not good enough. And I always try and encourage them to just keep going down that route that they found for themselves, because that's them rather than me telling them who they should be. They're kind of finding themselves by almost making mistakes. And that's the nice thing about, you know, student-led activity, is it, in a way, it kind of almost allows you to learn even better, I think. I mean, I don't know, because I'm not a not a scientist or education specialist, but I just feel like that kind of switches kids on more, working in that way a lot of the time.
You're so right. I couldn't agree with you more. Next question. Off the top of your head, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
So you probably know who I'm talking about, and maybe some other people do as well. I had a tuba teacher at the Guildhall School called Patrick Harold, who used to be the principal tuba of the London Symphony Orchestra, and he's an infamous character in the classical music scene in the UK. And he just had phrase after phrase after phrase. They were just catchphrases almost, but they all made perfect sense, and they all applied to everything that I was doing. And it was just, he's like the ultimate communicator when it comes to teaching music. He doesn't talk about technique. It's all about just musicianship first and foremost. The best phrase of his kind of top phrase, which will always stay with me, it's kind of like a play on the sign of the cross, and it's in time, in tune, with a good and appropriate sound.
Very nicely put.
And I use it for everything.
Do you have a piece of music or an album, something that you'll always go back to, no matter what?
You've totally stumped me, because, I mean, there's so many things, but then if I name one of them, then I'm forgetting about the other one. I hate this kind of questions. Probably anything by Gentle Giant. Just anything. They always put a smile on my face whenever I hear them. And they're just totally unique and totally innovative and just hilarious. And I just don't think any other music that I know kind of sums me up more than that band.
Which musical moment gives you the biggest rush of emotion or the biggest goosebumps?
Who Wants to Live Forever by Queen. Just stunning. I love it. Always gives me goosebumps.
You can ask one composer or creative musician anything. Who would it be, and what would you ask?
Kerry Munir, who I'm sure no one's heard of. Probably the sole songwriter for Gentle Giant. Just how? How? He actually went to the Royal Academy and studied composition. He was in the same year as Paul Koch, who was a trumpet prof at Guildhall, when I was there and when you were there. And they were best mates, and they were best man at each other's weddings. And Kerry Munir is just a genius.
Which composer would you bring back to life in order to see their reaction to today's music, and even see their reaction to how their own music is being played today?
Probably someone old. I mean, it would be really interesting to see how Bach thought of how people play his music now, because it's like from one player to another, you're talking about a completely different world almost, just with the same piece. And that's one thing that's always kind of fascinated me about his music, is how do you actually play it? Like, what's the right way to play it? I don't know. And I guess it's the same thing with any kind of historical performance, if that's kind of the correct way to think about it.
You've been given a blank check for a musical project. What would you do?
These are the most horrible questions. what would I do? I mean, it wouldn't feel right to do anything other than some kind of huge outreach project for kids who just otherwise wouldn't, you know, get the same kind of musical upbringing that I've been fortunate enough to have. And there's just millions of kids out there who could benefit from something like that.
Agreed.
Probably, yeah, probably quite a popular answer, I'd have thought, though.
You'd be surprised. You can go to any musical happening in history, concert, recording session, rehearsal, your choice.
I'd be interested to hear what actually happened at the first performance of The Rite of Spring, because there's so many contrasting views what happened there, and it's such a monumental, important piece. But then again, I keep telling people all the time that if there was anyone I could have seen, it would have been, again, Gentle Giant. I just missed the boat with them. And I've seen them in kind of more modern iterations where one or two of them might be in the band and then the rest of them are session guys. But to see the real deal kind of in Golders Green and that venue where they filmed like a BBC TV production for one of their shows, and it was just the best thing. It's like the best thing on YouTube. I love it.
We're on the home stretch now. Nice, easy question. How can we follow what you're up to and also what Haken is up to?
Oh, this is so easy. Thanks. but I am on Instagram and Facebook. I don't really have anything else going on social media wise. And then Haken are also on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. And we have a Twitch account, Haken Official. Haken Official for Instagram, probably Haken Official for Facebook. I'm Ray Haken on Instagram, Ray Hearn Music on Facebook. The usual places, easy enough to find.
Ray, thank you so much for your time. It's been so much fun talking through this piece with you and talking about your music and your processes. I'm a huge fan of the band, and I'm also a massive fan of your drumming. I think you sound incredible, and it's such a joy to listen to you. Most of all, though, it's just been such a pleasure to see you after all this time.
Thanks again so much for having me. It's been great. And it's been so good to just get in so deep with all this stuff. I love it.
Thanks. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ray Hearn. Here's his own review of our conversation together.
Man, that was tough.
Sorry, Ray. If you enjoyed the music, please do go and listen to Haken's incredible catalogue and look out for them on tour when we're all allowed to gig again. We'll be back on the 17th of February with one of the UK's finest vocalists, Sarah Dowling. Sarah will be taking us through her heart-wrenching ballad, You've Got My Heart on a String. And I'm sure that her expressive and colourful voice will have you by the heartstrings by the time we're done. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep in touch, visit us at soundspring.co.uk. You can connect with us on Instagram by searching for Soundspring Pod, or you can send us an email at soundspringpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you like what you've heard, please spread the word, and don't forget to give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to reach new listeners. If you enjoy the show and want to support our podcast, you can donate or become a patron of the show at patreon.com/soundspringpodcast. Obviously, we encourage you to go and buy our guests' music. But once you've done that, and only once you've done that, you can also stream most of the music featured in the show by searching for the Soundspring Podcast playlist in Spotify. And finally, I'd like to thank Katie Stevenson for her beautiful artwork. Please go and follow her work on social media by searching for Cub and Bloom. This is Tommy Andrews, signing off until next time.